the 7th, and members present are Representative Kopanen, Boucher, Bernard, Davidson, Ellis, and Donnelly. Representative Boucher has a medical appointment he has to go to, so he's going to be excused. Thank you, Representative Boucher.
Get well, Red. Get well.
Oh, yeah. I just got this infection in my lung. I'm not shaking, so I gotta go shot. So anyhow, I'll be back. Okay.
Today we're going to be taking up the infamous omnibus licensing bill from the Department of Commerce, and that's House Bill 222, and then two measures, House Bill 218 and 219, creating the Alaska Center for International Business at the University of Alaska. And then, but before that, I think we've got two committee measures, and we've been joined by Representative Furness, the Happy Hour Bill, Mike Gordon, one of the new appointees to the Alcohol Control Board, is here to testify on that. And I see Harvey Liddens that's also here regarding the painting bill and Marisa King. So we might want to go ahead and take those. Mr. Gordon, would you join us here at the table? Even the piles of things you have in front of you here, you have the draft and the alcohol, the happy hour legislation. It's just a piece of draft legislation that we originally approved with the understanding that there would be an agreement reached with MAD and some of the other groups. And subsequently, there was some disagreement about the contents of the legislation. Jacob, did you have anything you wanted to state to the committee about this legislation before Mr. Gordon makes this?
I'm not sure. I think that the way the bill is structured before you, you see the language of the existing statute that's being deleted, and the additional language, the new language is being added. I think that it's fairly easy to follow it to see what the effects of this would be, and I think that Mr. Gordon would be a better person to explain it from there.
Would you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Mike Gordon, I'm here representing myself as a beverage dispensary operator and also part of the CHAR. Mr. Chairman, when this bill was in the process of being drafted last year, we had occasion to talk to Senator Fisher and a number of other people who were party to drafting it, and we overlooked a couple of items, and it became a lot more of a problem as the year progressed and as the bill took effect. The major problem that we have with this particular bill is its interference with our ability to market our product. It's a happy hour bill by name, but by actual nature it's a lot more than that. And we're not suggesting that we should go back to happy hours. We're not asking for that. Nobody in the association thinks that that's a good idea. We would, however, like to be able to price our products competitively on a daily basis. The way the bill is, the way the law is written right now, if you have a special price on a Michelob or a Heineken or something, on a Wednesday night, you have to carry that price for the entire week, and of course nobody's going to be there over a weekend. They're going there at night. So we'd just like to be able to have a bit of flexibility in the pricing of our product. As you're, I'm sure, aware, there's times that might be necessary where you have product that maybe you bought too much of that the public didn't like, and you need to arrange some way to get rid of it. But we're not talking about here squeezing it into a limited number of hours where people would tend to drink too much and stack drinks and that kind of thing. Anyway, I wanted to talk about that first because that was the key issue that brought this whole thing up. However, there's a change in Section 1 from advertise, promote, or give public notice that free alcoholic drinks are given to customers to offer or deliver as a marketing device to the general public free alcoholic beverages to a patron. Oh, wait a minute. We're deleting offer or deliver as a marketing device to the general public free alcoholic beverages to a patron, and putting in that we can't advertise, promote, or give public notice. In other words, we'd like to be able to give somebody a free bottle of champagne on their anniversary, or buy them a drink at the cocktail waitress, pull something in their lap, or just buy them a drink as a promotional matter on our premises, as the owner or host of the premises. But we don't expect that we should be able to advertise to the general public that we're having free drinks all night long, or free drinks of any kind. So that takes care of 1, 3 I've already spoken to. Number 5 was a section that was put in the legislation last year to prohibit things like ladies' nights, etc. It also prohibits the practice of, for instance, during softball season, being able to offer dollar beers to people in uniform that come in after games and so forth. And again, it's an area that we feel that goes a bit beyond the prohibiting of happy hours. So there again, we're looking for just some flexibility in the operation.
Representative Prince.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could ask a couple of questions. Mr. Gordon, if we could go past the section 1 first. The language, line 14, 15, reflects 16. The old language says you could not offer or deliver as a marketing device to general public free alcoholic beverages to a patron. That's being changed to you may not advertise, promote, or give public notice that free alcoholic drinks are given to customers. I assume that that new language is accepted.
Yes, it is. That new language, Mr. Chairman, is taken practically directly out of the Municipality of Anchorage's ordinance. And it does prohibit, you know, advertising and promoting free drinks, but the way it's written right now could be construed and has been construed by some people to mean that we cannot give a free drink away even on our own premises.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, let me interject. It looked like the old language for sure said that because you could not offer or deliver as a marketing device to the public. So the old language for sure would not permit you. But now reading the new language, advertise, you may not advertise, promote, or give public notice that alcoholic drinks are given to customers. Oh, it said free alcoholic drinks. In this case, you wouldn't, if you wanted, for example, someone's coming in with an anniversary and you wanted to deliver them a bottle of champagne, you'd not advertise nor promote that that's a policy or whatever. It's something that is somewhat of a spontaneous gift.
It's an internal policy, yeah.
Right, marketing is not really a spontaneous marketing gesture, and it appears that the new language would not hinder that. You didn't advertise it, nor are you promoting it, that you're doing it. It is something that you internally have decided you would do on an as-needed basis.
That's correct.
Okay. I would think that would probably be the interpretation of the rest of the memory in there. You know, that's fine. I wouldn't want to read it.
I honestly don't feel that the items that we're asking for are a reason for any kind of outrage on anybody's part, although I know that that's happening in certain quarters. Some people would prefer that we not be able to promote our product in any fashion.
Right, right. If I may go to the second one, then on lines 21.
Representative Curtis, if we're dealing with paragraph 1, I just had a question about paragraph 1, too. I just, why you brought it up. Is it now... The Alcohol Beverage and Control Boards interpreted the old language to mean what your testimony identified earlier. You can't replace a spilled drink, and you can't give a free bottle of champagne.
That's the way I understand it, by the way some of the enforcement people are reading it. Yes, and it's a real problem enforcement wise, and it's an awfully restrictive kind of.
So what your position is that when this legislation was put before the legislature last year, it wasn't their intent to do that, but the language has been subsequently interpreted by the enforcement agency, the board, to mean that.
I believe that's true, guys. I don't think that it was the intent. I was told frequently myself by Senator Fisher that that was not the intent, and he advised me that if he was reelected this year, that we could work together on trying to correct it. And so, I mean, some of these things just caused by surprise last year. It was a very emotional issue, and frankly, I don't think the bill was very well thought out. I think, and there are people who disagree with me, of course, but I think that the municipal ordinance is more fairly drafted and more and better thought out than this is. And
Representative Copeland.
Yes, I think the intent is fairly clear in the original. I'm not opposed to changing it, but it does say, you know, offer or deliver as a marketing device to the general public, you know, as a advertising, so on. I can't see how it could have been more plainly put, actually. But what the heck, if they want to change, they want to change.
Well, any time that you give somebody a free drink in the bar, it could be considered a marketing device.
And that's the way the board interpreted it last year or so.
I think they're choosing to interpret it in the swiftest fashion.
Representative Davidson, Representative Furness.
Chairman, changing Section 1A, where we have what rights or privileges accrue to the licensee's agent or employee that no longer accrue to the holder of a license or licensee. Am I reading this thing too closely?
Well, I didn't actually come here prepared to testify on this morning, and I don't know exactly what the reason for that is. I think that's probably just cleaning up the wordage in there. I don't know.
But cleaning up the wordage, we're severing the or, which connects the licensee and the licensee's agent or employee.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. We're taking out a licensee or a licensee's agent or employee. We're changing to the holder of the license issue.
So somebody that owns a bar in Anchorage that has the license, lives in California, it could be his agent or employee that could do any and all of the above, or am I just being too nitpicky here? I think it...
The holder of the license issue.
I think I have a tendency to agree with Representative Kaponin that I don't see how the language could have been more clearly stated, but I just would like to have some clarification on my question.
Well, I think Representative Davidson, I think your interpretation is correct. Under the proposal as it sits here, it would exclude the licensee's agents or employees, and it may be the decision of the committee if they want to pursue the legislation to leave that section alone to include those.
When that takes over, Mr. Chair.
Representative Furness.
I would assume here that the ultimate responsibility goes to the holder of the license. That holder of the license is responsible for the conduct of the employee. Therefore, the new language, in my opinion, would be all-inclusive. The holder of the license issued under this title, for purposes of where privilege is sold, etc., would be all-inclusive. Because if they bring an action, they don't bring an action against an employee, they bring an action against the license.
Yes, that's
true.
And that license is...
Explain it better, right?
Okay.
Thank you.
And then, Bernard?
Well, I was just thinking, coming down to line 14, where we are making the change, I can see what Mr. Gordon is talking about, as far as if you offer someone a drink, I think it can be construed as a marketing device. And language on that, certainly we should allow some flexibility on that, and I don't have any opposition on the graded matter either. Anyway, as long as we're staying on that.
Okay. Well, Representative Furness, if that concludes the discussion of section, that part of section one, you were going to continue on?
Yeah, I think I can. I'm fairly clear. It appears that again, the change on lines 10 appear to be fairly consistent again because the action is against the license, and the remedy for any violation would be to pull the license. This 13 through 16 appears to be more of a clarification of what the legislature intent, or at least the original passage, and may have gotten off a little bit. The other, if I may draw attention to lines 21, perhaps reading lines 19 through 23, yes, we may not sell, offer to sell, or deliver beverages. Thinking here, if there's opposition to the weak, that change the beverage during the charge for the beverage during the same calendar week, you want to change it to calendar day. If we follow your rationale whereby, if first of all, you don't want to get stuck with a pricing of a product that, in essence, you could lose money. What if you made that two calendar days? And by two calendar days, the rationale would be here. It's a means to an end. One is you need some flexibility. Two, there is a concern that you would use it as a technique to jockey that price up and down to suit the baseball team, the bowling team, or whatever. But if the intent here is for inventory control and for pricing stability, then if you take it to 2 days, it sort of takes the pressure off of, you know, some particular concerns. Does that make sense?
So you're saying that you would, what would be the effect of what you're saying on pricing?
The effect on pricing, for example, if you were forced to, under the original language using wheat, if you lower the price of Michelob to $1, then you would have to carry that for a whole week.
Okay, you're saying that I would only have to carry it for 2 days.
For 2 days. Way. Right. Now, the trade-off is this. The Mad Group is going to beat us to pieces on this. Because the intent of putting a week was to prevent that sporadic marketing to encourage particular groups, bowling teams, softball teams, to come in and, you know, chug a lug, 50 cases of Michelob.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, that's a reasonable marketing tool. However, if it's your intent here to use it, again, you've got something that you need to push. Maybe you got 100 cases of it. And for one day, you say, well, I'm going to lower this to $1. In essence, rather than having just a one-day special, you have to carry that for a longer period of time, say 2 days. Psychologically, it serves as a means to an end.
Well, 2 days is a lot better than a week. For my point of view, 1 day would be the best.
Okay. Well,
I mean, you know, I have no ownership of it. Just an idea of it. Mm-hmm. I'm looking back when we have to explain why. Well, they say, well, gee whiz, you know, these groups are coming in and all of a sudden they're chug-a-lugging 50 cases. Well, you know, chances are you're not going to have a chug-a-lug for 2 days. But it gives you at least inventory control.
Well, when you've got a pricing, Mr. Chairman, structure of where you can't raise your prices unless you've got entertainment coming on at a certain time and you're open for, like I am, from 9:30 to 2:30 or 3 with the entertainment, that's a long time anyway, you know. People run out of steam a long time before they consume too much, or I think, or at least, I mean, they can't chug lug for that long. I mean, it stretches it out far enough where chug lugging is not really an issue, you know what I mean?
Well, then, the 2 days would be the intent where it's not an issue.
Okay. Well, Section 5 then seems to cover the situations where you have the special groups like a softball team, such like that. Section 6 changes permit to promote.
Mr. Chairman, the change was put in there essentially because some operators were concerned that they might get sideways with the law by having a couple of people play for beer over a pool table and them not be aware of it. However, since it's on their premises, they are in fact permitted it, or it could be construed that they were permitted it. So, you know, they don't want to be allowed to promote that type of activity and encourage it, but they don't want to be held responsible for it if it happens without their knowledge, because it's bound to happen.
Would it be
in the real world?
Yeah. When Senate Bill 138, which was the happy hour bill that was adopted, was passed, it was adopted with a letter of intent from the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee that went ahead and passed along the bill. Of course, we understand the letter of intent is not statute, but the letter of intent said that it was clear that the committees intended that this bill only deal with the behavior of the license holder, and in no way was intended to be construed to hold the license holder responsible for the actions of their patrons. That was the compromise as far as trying to address this. It doesn't let anyone off the hook, but it just made it clear that the legislature's intent was not to hold the license holder responsible if somebody at the end of the bar was throwing dice for a drink.
Okay, let's be consistent.
And then the final change is the provision at the bottom of the stack there, number four, that increasing prices during times when entertainment is provided. It seems pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, there's never, I don't think there's ever been any argument about that.
Okay. One question, would you actually increase price or would you decrease price during the time of entertainment?
Most people increase them because of the cost of the entertainment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Representative Menard?
Decrease if you get them in there.
I'll
have to try that sometime.
Not particularly with the bill, but I do have a question that I'd like to ask Mike on. A constituent of mine in my district said that there is a problem with the law as far as someone that is intoxicated on the premises and how that goes. But his point was that if someone drives up that and walks in the bar and is intoxicated, that it was his understanding that you had to direct him off the premises. You were not allowed to keep him on the premises to give him coffee or let him go rub or anything like that. And I'm just asking that as a question. Is that your interpretation? Or
my understanding of the law has always been that technically you're not allowed to have an intoxicated person on your premises.
So, in other words,
there are many people in the past who have, in the public interest, broken that law in order to send a more or a less inebriated person out the door by giving them coffee or trying to sober up.
I guess sometime in the future, my constituent was concerned if we could address that issue in the fact that, and he was citing the case where someone drove in, where if he did the strict interpretation of the law, he would be forced to put that person back in the car and get him off the premises, which he felt, you know, it was not in a reasonable thing. He would much rather, you know, put him where he can have some coffee or something like that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Jerry, did you want to...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we got involved in that issue last year, and it just touched off a big firestorm, because there's not only that problem, Mr. Chairman, there's also the problem that the legislature has created what may be a questionable situation where the person who comes through the door intoxicated commits a misdemeanor. There may be some constitutional problems with it. So we were trying to clean that up in an ABC by cleanup bill. It got into the darndest campfire. Coghill tried to take care of the problem. So, like everything else, when you get into this issue, it had nothing to do with the facts. It got very emotional. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the way it stands now, you've got to run them out the door the way the statute reads.
Well, should. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to elaborate a little bit on that. Particularly in the smaller communities and the smaller operations, that's a more likely thing to happen because these places can't afford the kind of security staff that some of us in town do, and so people actually do get in there and are on the premises, you know, where you're having to deal with them under that situation rather than at the door saying, I'm sorry, you can't come in.
Well, what I'd like to do is get a subcommittee to take a look at this legislation and try to hammer out some compromise position on these issues. I'm going to work on it. Is there anyone, other members of the committee?
I'll work with you, too. I have one other question.
Okay.
Mr. Gordon, you mentioned lines 13 through 17 that the municipality had some language that may be clear than what's in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the language that's used, and I got into a lot of trouble with this right off the bat with Catherine Bigler when she and I talked recently, because I said that we were using something in the municipal ordinance to clear this up. But I mean, the fact is, in this particular instance anyway, the municipal ordinance, I think, more clearly addresses the problem. The municipal ordinance doesn't allow us to promote or advertise free drinks and say, okay, everybody come on over, we're giving booze away tonight. But it doesn't prohibit us from buying somebody the bottle of champagne or buying somebody the drink if the drink spilled on them or something of that nature that's internally done strictly as a policy kind of arrangement. The way this is written in the state statute, it can be and is being interpreted in a stricter fashion that's likely to create some unnecessary problems.
If we may follow up. Mr. Gordon, do you by chance have a copy of that municipal statute?
I can certainly get you one.
Probably a term order. We can just look at that and see. Now, did Mrs. Bigler endorse or support the municipal's language?
Well, I'm not going to get in the middle of this and say what Catherine Bigler supports or doesn't support. I personally get along with Catherine Bigler quite well, but we disagree on lots of areas. And I've just tried to keep things on a reasonable level with her and try to work things out that are in the public interest, but also allow us to operate our businesses in a sensible fashion.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and appoint the subcommittee of Representative Furness, Menard, and myself to deal with this issue and come back to the committee with a bill of some form or another. And I've got to turn the gavel over to Representative Copeland at this time because we have a Labor and Commerce bill before the Judiciary Committee to justify our whistleblower bill.
Which bill?
Whistleblower bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
The next bill before us is House Bill 222, the Omnibus Licensing Bill. I'm not sure that we license omnibus anymore, but it deals with occupational licensing. Mark can come up and give us an explanation.
I'm Kathy Marshall, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing, representing the Department of Commerce. The department requested these amendments to the Centralized Licensing Act, and our primary intent was to try to standardize and make uniform a number of provisions that vary from board to board. This is really a beginning step, and I wanted to stress that. Possibly during the interim, the Code Revision Commission is going to be working on a more intensive version. However, the things contained in here are primarily housekeeping. There are three substantive areas, though. Section 6 not only standardizes but increases the disciplinary powers of boards. Right now, all boards can revoke or suspend a license, but that's about where the similarity ends. There's a whole bunch of variety of things that boards can do. And so we wanted to make all of those available to all boards. The critical provision in here is in Section 7 in terms of the division, and that is to require or give us the authority to put all boards on a biennial renewal. Right now we have 8 boards that are on a quadrennial renewal, and that makes our revenue fluctuate from year to year, which means that every so often we have to request general funds. So if this were to pass, we would be able to have a given amount of program receipts each year, and the division could be totally funded from the program receipts. We would no longer have to ask for general funds. Section 10 is the last substantive provision, and that is it gives the department the authority to issue citations. Right now, we can issue cease and desist orders when someone is practicing without a license. But a cease and desist order carries with it a provision for a hearing, which is very time-consuming and expensive process. And it sometimes takes us a year to get somebody to stop practicing without a license. The citation authority would be much quicker and cheaper, and we would. What it does is require a mandatory court appearance and There's a penalty associated with each contending day of practice. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Just not a question about a comment. I have probably received more mail concerning this bill than any other piece of legislation in the last week or so. So I think we got to move real quick.
In support of this?
Yes.
Oh.
Amazing.
Is there any other questions? For occupational licensing or occupational therapists?
It's HB 222.
Well, that must be a therapist. Are there any questions?
They probably section 10, the citation for unlicensed practices, is going to require some discussion. I'm sorry that the chair is not here at this point, but. Are you satisfied that that won't get you involved in various sorts of lawsuits for unlicensed activity? I'm thinking of the whole harangue we had about naturopaths some years ago.
Now, we currently have this provision for the contractors, and it's worded almost identically. And I've talked to the court system and given them an approximate number of cases that this would be appropriate for. They see no repercussion in the court system and have not put on a fiscal note or anything. They feel that they can handle it.
Do you have that particular backup? The number of cases?
I think it was 53 cases in a two-year period. I don't have that included in here in the packet.
I think you'd have certified
that. Okay. It's really an excellent process in that, you know, somebody's either licensed or they're not licensed, and we can verify that instantly. All we do is call up, you know, look it up in the computer, and if they aren't licensed, and that's why very few of them even go through a court process, and no one challenges it, because it's either you are licensed or you aren't licensed. And that's why the old process is no good, because they get the right to a hearing under the old process, and that's just, it's ridiculous to spend the state's time and money giving a person a hearing when it's very clear that they're licensed.
Clear this up for me. A person who would receive a citation is one who is not licensed in a particular trade or profession and passes themselves off as practicing that trade or profession.
Right.
Not necessarily somebody who is practicing a related trade or profession.
Absolutely, no. There would be no one who is licensed would get a citation. Only people who are unlicensed to practice.
That's not quite the question. The question was that, well, for example, you have a number of individuals who have training that qualifies them to do one sort of counseling or another. If someone were trained to be, marital counselor, for example, they could not pass themselves off as a clinical psychologist. That would obviously be a violation. But they may be counseling the same person who may go to a clinical psychologist for a problem that appears to be roughly the same, and acting under their own shingle, with marriage counselor, pastoral counselor, something like that. The question is, would the board of clinical psychologists attempt to issue a citation against that person because they were undertaking and doing counseling, which there is a I've noticed I support peer review and professional standards upheld by the members of the profession, but I do notice there's a certain protectionist curve that goes along with that, and a certain sort of all-inclusive nature of the definition of curve.
Well, this does not authorize the boards to issue citations, only the department. And so it would only be our investigative staff that would do that. And we have very clear guidelines about what is the scope of practice for each of the professions. In the situation that you just described, the only time we would issue a citation would be if the person said, Jane such and such psychological services, where they were presenting themselves as a psychologist, and we do license psychologists, and yet they did not have a license as a psychologist. It's a very clear-cut kind of procedure. It's just like getting a traffic ticket.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another occupation that we've had discussion with, about before, and that's the midwifery, midwifery. Have we resolved that licensing process?
No, and that's in the Department of Health and Social Services. They're working on regulations, I believe, but we don't deal with them.
No, but would that occupation fall under this, or would that would be separate under the medical?
They're not under the. They're over in health and social services, so it wouldn't even apply to them at all.
We are looking at bringing up that group there. Yes, yes.
Okay. I just in the process.
Are there any other questions? Are there any other witnesses? Thank you.
What was the intent on this legislation?
The intent of the chair was to have to move it.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 222 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection?
And ask for unanimous consent.
Any objection? And the next one is a. Center for International Business. Committee substitutes before us. We had this bill before.
Which one is it?
Originally by the committee, governor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could, I'll go over the changes that the CS have been made in the CS. They're nothing substantive. There was a drafter's error in section 3, the last section, or the second to last section of the bill, and what we're proposing is that the Alaska Center for International Business exists for 10 years so that the legislature and the governor have an opportunity to judge its effectiveness and its usefulness. And by virtue of creating a sunset in 1997, that will give the legislature an opportunity to review the effectiveness and make a decision whether it should be carried forward. The other change, which is a slight modification of the language, was up near the top of page 3, section E. Originally, as introduced, we had language which charged the Commissioner of Administration with separately accounting for the fees that were earned by the center, and upon reflection we realized that it would be more appropriate for the President of the University of Alaska as a constitutionally separate entity to provide that accounting. And the only other change is that, and this was a drafter's change primarily, was throughout where we had referred to, let me see if I get this right, Alaska, apparently using the legislative drafting form, that's been changed to the state. And it's merely a technicality, doesn't alter the thrust of the legislation at all. If I could, I'd be happy to go through the bill with you or answer any questions, whatever the committee's pleasure.
We had this bill before, so I think it's
for it. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, since 218 and 219 are basically the same legislation, I'd like to get to 219
for a little bit.
The appropriation.
Right.
I'd like to go to 219.
Sure.
I understand the 400. I don't understand the 5 million. How that
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, as the governor indicated in his state of the state message, what he desires to establish is an entity within the university that provides, one, basic information to business persons throughout the state on international markets and marketing opportunities, provide assistance to school districts and educational programs throughout the state to help students within the state to understand Alaska's relationship to the Pacific Rim and the world in general, and to develop educational tools which allow us to participate in the world marketplace. And three, be a service to people who are involved in international business to learn the protocol of national cultures of countries with which we propose to do business. So that's the intent. The $5 million appropriation, the thinking is that we should endow the center with the $5 million and allow it to operate from the earnings of that endowment. The $400,000 is, of course, an appropriation for this next fiscal year because the earnings won't be available immediately to allow it to start up.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I don't seem to have anything other than this unless I'm missing something.
I've got some information.
We're flagged up earnings projections. Is the $5 million invested at a certain rate? Generates a certain amount of money. Is staffing up the center? You know, that kind of information.
Right now.
So that's been passed out by.
Have Mr. Rogers here from the university budget.
I have some material, too, if I could. This is an implementation plan that Dr. Kim has developed.
This is Dr. Kim's program, sir.
Right now, the university has budgeted approximately $320 million for the center. $160,000 of that is general funds. There are, the remainder is other sources unidentified. It's our thinking that the $400,000 identified here in Section 1 of HB 219 would provide the additional funds to make up what the university feels is necessary to start out the program. It's also contemplated that the center would seek out additional funds through foundations, private corporations, et cetera, to assist it in funding its activities.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this information is very helpful. I have not seen it before. Over the years, Dr. Kim has basically bugged the hell out of us concerning this, so to make a long story short.
Yeah. there have been some questions raised by other members of the legislature, some that we answered in the committee. And that's the appointment of the 7 advisors who are concerning the center, whether it's thought sufficient to give the regents the authority to select and appoint the members after consultation with the governor. Do you have a comment before you let the university answer that?
I do have one comment, Mr. Chairman. I have another piece of paper if I could pass out, and this is a basic organizational design of the governor's trade program that he announced on Friday in Anchorage at the Resource Development Council. And if you can look at the bottom box where we have a number of assets of our economic development and international trade problems, one of those entities is the Alaska Center for International Business. Also, at the top, we propose to establish a board of directors to help guide the state's efforts in trade and economic development.
It's our hope that through consultation with the governor, the Board of Regents would see fit to appoint persons who are sitting on the board of directors of the Trade Alaska program to at least two, maybe three seats of the center's board of directors, so that we can assure that the state's efforts and the university's efforts are directed in the same fashion and going along the same line. Beyond that, I have no comment as to how the board should be selected.
Mr. Yes, through the chair, a question that goes to the investment of the $5 million. Perhaps you may not have information, but can you share with us any strategies as to how that would be invested in control of whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, I really am not familiar with the operations of the University of Alaska Endowment.
I do have Dr. O'Dowd, one in Redmond, and Brian Rogers here to speak to the university.
I did see him.
And they're the next. Any more questions for Dr.
Coleman, did you mean to throw out the figure $320 million?
Did I say 320? No, it's 320,000 is budgeted. I'm sure they would like 320,000.
They're back there, I guess we can ask.
Blank check.
Any further questions for Mr. Holman?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we would like to comment, if possible, on the issue of how the funds were invested by the foundation. Mr. Rogers knows it very well.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Brian Rogers, Director of Budget Development for the University of Alaska System. The University of Alaska Foundation is a private nonprofit corporation which was established to receive and hold endowment monies for the university. The actual management is done by of the funds done by university employees under the direction of the University of Alaska Foundation Board of Directors, and the funds are invested basically on trust fund basis, and income earned on any investments then is available for university purposes. This is very similar to an endowment created by the legislature 3 or 4 years ago, an endowment for physical sciences, where the legislature appropriated money to the university for the foundation. The income from that then is available for an endowed chair in natural sciences currently at the Fairbanks campus. Those funds, it's just a basic trust fund arrangement, long-term investments, very secure, basically follow the same rules as are used by the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees. In terms of the nature of investments that we use, I should mention that the university is, as part of this arrangement, we have transferred some funding, reduced the funding for the statewide administration and transferred funding in until and including the current year. The Alaska Center for International Business has $11,200 in state general funds, and Dr. Kim's operation has been going just on that $11,000. We're adding $168,000 in a reduction to statewide administration to provide a base level, which would be a director and 4 faculty members, roughly 50% funded from general funds. We would anticipate that they would go out and get grants and contracts for the other 50% of their funding. In addition, they would have this roughly $400,000 a year if we assume an 8% rate of return. $400,000 the first year is definite. After that, it would be based on whatever the investment earnings might be.
Chairman, in fact, I have just one last question. Perhaps, Brian, if you could share, you may not have any information, but just yields of the endowments to date, the kinds of things you've been looking at. Let me preface that again. I noticed in one of the statements here, the interest earned on the $5 million endowment may not be sufficient enough to support all the needed staff to perform the service task. The Senate's committed to raising more endowment funds to bring this fund. I had to raise all the funds from many sources, such as federal, state, local, agency, private, foundations, etc. So,
The foundation right now is earning at comparable levels to the permanent fund or the general fund in terms of investments. It's basically the same kind, although I don't believe there are any stock investments whatsoever in the foundation right now, primarily then in securities and other things that require a minimal amount of management time to we don't have a very large amount of endowments, and much of it is in land rather than that's been donated, let's say, or buildings that have been donated rather than financial assets. Mr. Chairman, if I could speak to one other issue. You did raise the question on the advisory board and appointment. My understanding is the governor set it up in this fashion because of the constitutional governance issue that the university and its operations have to be governed by the board. After consultation with the governor, I think one might expect that the governor had strong feelings about the membership, that the board would certainly take heed of that. And the governor's people are showing that the Trade Alaska plan, and that they would like to see some overlap between the Trade Alaska board and the advisory board for the center. But I think we'd run into a possible constitutional problem with a direct appointment by the governor of the advisory board for the center.
Any questions on that? I noticed that the center is only part of the whole structure of the district. Alderman, do you know how the governor intends to appoint this board up here in the district?
We're soliciting, nominations or suggestions, and certainly members of the legislature are welcome to contribute names that they feel would be helpful in getting this out there.
Thank you. Are there any further questions on this piece of legislation?
Just one comment, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned in just a while ago, Dr. Kim has been around for quite a while, and he has periodically shared with many of us the dream of the center. And while setting aside $5 million at this time may be a little tough to do, perhaps it was easy to do it in prior years when it was available. I know that the legislation goes through the HES committee and the finance committee. And with that in mind, I think each committee has an opportunity, particularly the finance committee, to look at the overall financing ability of the state in order to identify the $5 million to do this. So I'm prepared to support 219 and 218 and at least get them active in the process. I would so move, Mr. Chairman, the two separate bills with individual recommendations.
Okay, you'd like to move 219 also, the appropriation.
Right.
All right, we have a motion from Representative Curtis to move House Bill 218 and 219 to the next committee of approval and individual recommendations. Is there any objection? Is there being none? So ordered. Okay. Now we have. We have House Bill 201, Labor and Commerce, CS, held over, so, and we have the draft before us, which is 50675Z, Hine, dated April 3rd, 1987. And we have some witnesses to do it.
We have Harvey Linenschmidt from the Cambridge Union. He's not signed yet.
City, we're talking about a toxic poisoning of the nervous system. And the way that's transpiring is through solvents. We use many solvents and materials that we use. The solvents attach themselves to the body tissue and ends up in our nervous system, affecting our motor control, our entire nervous system. In the United States, painters as a whole apply 290 million gallons of solvent per year. This is based on a 1984 figure. You've heard everyone talk about the painter who was intoxicated. And painters are generally, they're working with the substance intoxicated, not from alcohol, but from the material that they're working with. What they have found through studies is solvent toxicity affects the memory, recalling of facts. They have blackouts. They have confusion. They have motor control loss. They end up with difficulty performing even the simplest functions, functions such as buttoning your clothes. This all comes with solvent toxicity. In Oregon, a medical center in Oregon conducted a study of 15 painters. They put together a comparison group of 30 non-painters, and this study was conducted over a period of 1 year. What they found is that the painters had a higher frequency of poor memory, personality change, sleep disturbance, taste, smells, dizziness, headaches, chronic coughs, sharp memory functions in comparison to the non-painters. They also found out that it was extremely difficult to retrain a person who has suffered these problems because of the memory loss. In California, at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, they conducted a study on 2,000 painters. What they found there was that 30% of the painters had bronchitis, 20% abnormal cell growth of the lungs, 10% pleural changes, and worst of all, we have the highest rate of cancer. We have a 40% higher rate of cancer as far as lung cancer. We have a 30% higher rate of cancer as far as throat cancer. And we have pancreas cancer. And all this comes from solvent toxicity. The state of Alaska has a right to know law on the books. That right to know law does nothing to address the problems that we're experiencing. We experience it through resins. We work with 3 and 4 parts. Systems of epoxies. We ingest this through our lungs. We get it through osmosis of the skin, and nobody's doing anything about it. We're finding workers dropping out of the workforce at 30 years of age because of these problems they've got. They're unable to function anymore. If we train the people, if you get the people trained so they can recognize what an isocyanate product is, or an MDI, or a TDI, and then you're going to prevent the problem. On the East Coast, you're starting to get workman's compensation claims because of solvent toxicity and neurotoxicity. These claims are astronomical, some of the settlements are coming out of. We don't need that in the state of Alaska. We've got enough problems. This bill would address that problem. We can stop people from dropping out of the workforce at an early age. We can get them trained, we can get them safe, and we can get more productivity. That's all I have. Answer any questions.
Representative Davidson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Linden Schmidt, oftentimes workers under risk will not, in fact, make the extra effort to make a safe working environment for themselves. And I know we've heard this argument as relates to this issue as well. And what effort has the union made to, in fact, encourage individuals to become responsible for their own safety?
I can only speak for our local. What we've started, and we started this actually about a year and a half ago, but this year alone, we're using the Alaska Health Project. I'm a taper by trade. I'm certainly not a physician. I do have available material. What the problem is, to date, we've spent between $12,000 and $15,000 in 1987 alone on safety and health classes for our workers. We're bringing in people from outside who are experts in this field, because we're certainly not, to train these people. And we're only doing it with 15 people in the class, and they're having to go 3 hours a night, 4 nights a week for this training. And what we have found is just this year alone, we're finding the workers on the site are taking better care of themselves. We had an instance, Fort Arkansas. We were down in Utilidors, we had people working out there, and they were spraying epoxy. And one of our contractors, the Maskey Furnishes, was a 99-cent throwaway white paper maps. It's for dust. It has nothing to do with resins and solvents and isocyanates. And the men were wondering why they were groggy down in there. There was no ventilation. Well, one of the workers that was working on that took our class. He bought his own respirator, he bought his own fan, and he made it safe for working condition. And the ridiculous part is production went up. If the employer had done this, he'd have had higher production. But we're finding training our own people, we're getting better production. So we're trying our end of it.
So then what I'm hearing is that had the present law been more adequately enforced, you feel that the individual workers would have, in fact, come around to understanding that the law was there, or the measures that they were supposed to take to, in fact, help themselves survive?
The law would help. The problem you're going to get into, when you buy a product, it will list on the container what's in there by volume. If you have a person who is not a chemical engineer and it's listed by trade name, they have not a clue what they're reading. They probably can't even pronounce it, much less protect themselves. So the container will say, take adequate precaution. If you don't know what the material is, how do you take out what is adequate precaution if you're not trained? We've started training our people in threshold levels, too. That has to do with parts prevalence as to what you can be exposed to. If you know what you're applying per hour and you know the threshold level on the weighted 8-hour average, then you know what kind of protection.
Just one more question. So do you see an increased effort on the part of industry or the employers in the industry?
For our part, none of the employers, be it union or non-union, the employers are doing nothing. Prime example is right here in Juneau. We did a remodel at the sewage treatment plant using a new type of epoxy. The people that applied it weren't painters by training. When you went down there, they didn't even have the 3M mask on the throwaways, and yet it was a highly toxic resin. It happened to be a 12-mil resin. That's the thickness of it. Extremely hard to apply. They had no protection. Their hands were blistered. Nobody trained them. And that's common practice. That's not unusual.
Thank you.
Are there
further questions for the witness?
Do you have any written material?
I have written material. I need to get copies made.
Our staff.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Has Risa King already participated?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the CS for House Bill 201 Labor and Power Peace Bill.
The motion is to have the committee substitute as the legislation before us. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the committee substitute is adopted. Risa, you're not on the list here, but did you want to testify? Are there any members of the public here to testify on this legislation? I see we have representatives from the Department of Labor available.
Is there any questions on medical
aspects?
I'm here to answer questions.
I have some questions.
Okay. Representative Copeland and Representative Davidson.
For the record, I'm Dr. Annette Thorne. I'm Medical Director of Occupational Health at the Boston Department of Labor, and my expertise is in the area of occupational exposures and toxic exposures.
Within the last 10 years, new materials have been introduced that are used in this particular trade that have effects that concern this bill?
Well, first of all, they're old materials that are extremely toxic that have been used for a long period of time that require a level of understanding and care and handling that is just now beginning to come out. And that's things like lead chromate. The lead can cause lead poisoning in painting of bridges and painting of equipment. The chromate in the lead chromate pigment is a carcinogen, and there's a carcinogenic risk. Benzene has been used for years in paints and it causes leukemia. So that there have been serious toxins and paints for a long period of time, and I wouldn't want to create the impression that it's only the new additives that are of concern. However, there are new agents like the organotins, which are being considered for the marine effects in another bill, that are now being used as anti-fouling agents, which have toxic effects to the skin and the respiratory tract. You've got isocyanates are very severe concern. I just got a call yesterday from a woman who's a carpenter who has been working for years in her field and suddenly developed an occupational asthma as a result of this exposure to the isocyanate in the paint. Now, she'd been working around it for years. There's no family history of asthma. She'd never had any asthma. It's unlikely she was ever going to have it except for this exposure. But now she has ongoing asthmatic problems. The other problem is that she wants to go back to the worksite because this is the only job she has. And I had to inform her that if she did, she stood a chance of anaphylactic shock. Once you develop a sensitivity to isocyanates, there is a risk very similar to a bee sting type of reaction in individuals, which can cause death. Many workers are not aware of this, and there are many exposures. Isocyanates are particularly useful because they provide a very durable, hard, shiny surface, and they're used especially in areas like Alaska, where weather endurance is very, very much needed. And epoxy paints are another sensitizer. It works in a different way, but can create significant skin and respiratory sensitivity reactions. So that's a serious consideration. We had an episode here in the Baranoff Hotel about 2 years ago, where trimethylbenzene type of varnish was being applied on the downstairs of the woodwork, and it was being spray applied, and the whole hotel had to be evacuated because of the toxic effects. 11 workers went to the emergency room. It was lack of knowledge and understanding of this agent. When I called the producer, they said, "How could this be? This should not be applied in the spray technique. This is, of course, it's going to cause you problems," and it caused severe pulmonary reaction in a number of the workers who were working with it. The public also becomes involved when you're not protecting workers appropriately and providing the proper enclosures and separation from other individuals. Other situations that have occurred in the state have been death from carbon monoxide poisoning and workers preparing a paint surface doing sandblasting. Not knowledgeable of how to use a compressor, and that the compressors need to be set up with filter systems and alarms so that when there is a dysfunction in the equipment, you don't get such excess levels of carbon monoxide that workers die from the exposure. And in fact, we've had several deaths, too, in the last 2 years from spray applications that required supplied air respirator use. So that there are sophisticated toxins, sophisticated effects, and a degree of sophistication is required in dealing with these chemicals. The newest evidence, however, is in the area that the previous person testifying spoke to, which is neurotoxicity. And the solvent exposures have been really well researched in the last few years, and it's become clear that severe organic brain dysfunction, like dementia, Alzheimer's type of problems, do occur in individuals who've had a long period of exposure to solvents. You can get a more intermediate type of response from these chronic solvent exposures with personality disorders, mood disorders, insomnia, and loss of short-term memory. So these problems that we were just told about are well documented in literature. As you're all aware of this, the immediate toxic effects of the acute effects of these neurologic responses to solvents and intoxication, very much like alcohol. They also have effects on the liver in terms of an acute hepatitis can occur from severe overexposure to the solvents.
Do any of these have any synergistic effect with aspirin, antihistamines, coffee, alcohol?
The main one, of some of them I may not be aware of, but the main concern is alcohol. Alcohol uses the same metabolic pathway as the solvents have to utilize for metabolic excretion and getting the metabolism necessary to rid the body of the substance. So there's such a similarity in metabolic excretion pathway that if you're drinking, you are more susceptible to the toxic effects, the brain effects of the solvent. And also, the solvent can create a intoxication problem that will create an increased susceptibility to alcoholism. Painters become used to and addicted to the solvent effects. They don't necessarily purposely expose themselves to get this toxic effect or intoxicant effect, but the years of exposure provide it. And there is a high rate of alcoholism among painters, and it's considered to be associated with the exposure.
Painters becoming involuntary foods.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You talked about the lack of knowledge and understanding, and certainly, sure, we all understand the necessity of the individual taking a certain amount of responsibility for his or her own safety. But it seems here that we've reached a point in the evolutionary process of new materials and even old materials, more knowledge about the old materials, that somebody apparently is not doing what is fair and equitable to our workforce, as well as even perhaps the industry people themselves, because if we're going to expect something of the industry that uses the products, perhaps we could rightly so expect more effort in the education about these products of the suppliers as well as the manufacturers. So, understanding it then that we do have, in fact, law on the books to enforce the right to know, my question is, what programs do we have in place to assist both the industry as well as individual workers to become knowledgeable about these hazards in the workplace? Yeah. And have we had any takers of these programs or the information that your agency has to offer?
Basically, what is available is when an employer requests help, the voluntary compliance section of our state OSHA program is available to go out and to monitor and give recommendations on what needs to be done to comply with the regulations.
Did you have any requests this past year?
I have to refer that question to Richard Arab, who administers the OSHA program. I'm a separate unit. The other thing that is available is if the worker is aware of a problem, say in a body shop where painting is being applied in to automobiles, which is one of our serious hazard areas, workers have called and complained, filed a complaint with OSHA, and investigations have occurred. Part of the problem with investigations is that often you don't find the exposure when our inspector goes out. They may shut down the operation so that nothing is found, cut way back on what they're doing so that the levels will go down. The other problem we have is we have levels of exposure which have not been updated since 1968 as far as state-of-the-art allowable limits. The allowable limits that are the same as the federal allowable limits are based on 1968 state-of-the-art knowledge. There is a move afoot on the federal level to consider updating all of our standards all at once to a new 1987 state-of-the-art knowledge, which would be a very good move, and it's hoped that the feds will do that because the state is not in a position at the present time with given resources to take that one on. We're working on asbestos right now, and that's a full-time job. Standard setting is a very long and involved process. So there are a couple of limitations there. Now, in terms of the right to know law, we do have a right to know program, and that is the requests to the Right to Know program, I will again refer you to there to let you know how many requests we've had and whether any of them have been in the area of painting. But I do know from problems that have been reported to me from workers that there are many problems out there in the workplace and a tremendous severe lack of understanding or knowledge, especially in the area of isocyanates, which can be fatal, in the area of lead-based paints, lead chromate-based paints, and the epoxies. There's tremendous problems out there.
Thank you. I'd like to hear from Mr. Arab about any inquiries of the voluntary nature of that program.
As for the record, I'm Richard Arab, Department of Labor, Occupational Safety and Health. We have approximately about 350 requests a year, or we do about 350 consultative inspections a year. Not all of that, obviously, is on painting. I can't give you the figures right now as to how many of those involve painters. But we do, and we normally do respond to every request that an employer will give. This is strictly an employer request, so only if the employer requests we provide this. Now, we also do compliance inspections, and that we do approximately 1,000 compliance inspections a year. And again, the majority of those inspections are done in construction. Now, some of it may be painting, some of it may, I can't really tell you. I do have the figures that I did get some figures on our how many establishments we cited for right to know violations. I've said that, and that's broken out by the industry group. And we do have also a person who does do right to know, assist employers with right to know. And our emphasis has been mostly in manufacturing this past year. She'll go out and audit various establishments to see if they have a right to know program, which includes everything from posting the right to know poster to having a written program in the training and having the right number of material safety data sheets.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I mentioned earlier about maybe perhaps we need to not only look at employers, but also suppliers as well as manufacturers. Could you expand on that? What is your feeling about getting them to do more in regards to getting people to know what types of products they're working with?
Yes, I agree with that. And right to know is basically the first attempt at that. I'm sure that more will be done on that. But the Right to Know program basically requires a manufacturer to provide what they call a material safety data sheet. And I don't have too many copies of this, but I got a couple of copies of two paint material safety data sheets, which includes not only the ingredients in the paint, but does talk about the health hazard effects and provide some information on how to protect yourself, how to use the product properly. And I'll just these two men see. So there, that is now a national program. Alaska adopted its Right to Know program before Federal OSHA adopted their Right to Know program. And so manufacturers are providing those types of information. And I, on a national level, I know there is other legislation that would expand that type of information.
Are there any further questions of the witness? Okay, no. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Dr. Thorne?
I just had one further point to make. We've seen with the asbestos worker certification program tremendous strides. Asbestos is covered by the worker right to know law. The employers had a responsibility to inform workers of the risks of asbestos exposure and provide them with a material safety data sheet for materials that they were working with that had asbestos in them. However, with the implementation of the worker right to know, I mean the asbestos worker certification program, we've had workers going through 4 days of training, developing a full day of understanding why this is important, the medical effects, having, in some cases they show them films of affected workers talking about their problems, so you can get workers when they're young, before they're injured, and impress upon them the importance and the consequences. And once workers are aware of the consequences, it's been my experience that they're very good at protecting themselves and suggesting to employers. They have more knowledge on which to suggest to employers that different protective actions be taken when the employers haven't thought of it and may not be knowledgeable. With the asbestos worker right to know law, we've had a real improvement in employers' compliance with asbestos regulations because the employees are on the site. They know what needs to be done. They're trained in the regulations themselves as well as in the health hazards. And they are trained in the engineering controls and the protective respirators that are available, the limitations of the different kinds of respirators in different kinds of situations. Using half-mask respirator in certain situations, supplied air respirator in situations like isocyanates, which can have fatal effects. Knowing when and where to apply them makes a huge difference. The other thing is that with the asbestos worker certification, the workers actually went through hands-on utilization of the skills and protective equipment. So they knew how to operate a supplied air respirator. They knew how to fit a negative pressure respirator, so they knew they had a good seal and were getting optimum effect out of it. This is something that we try to get out of our normal OSHA actions and so on. We've seen a huge qualitative difference in the area of asbestos work, which is a highly hazardous type of work, and I would suggest that this painting work is also highly hazardous and similar significance. So that the worker right to know only goes so far. It requires that material safety data sheets be made available and the employer provide some instruction. But often you'll find the employers are not as knowledgeable as they need to be. Having organized courses that are well monitored by the Department of Labor employees results in a much higher level of competence.
Any further questions? There's no one else to testify on this legislation. Seeing the President Copeland.
Committee substitute for House Bill 201, Labor and Commerce Program Act Committee of earlier in the year.
Are there any objections to the motion? Seeing no objections, the motion passes. Next matter to come before the committee is a piece of proposed committee legislation. That's draft bill number one. This has been before the committee before. There's a brief memo explaining what it's about. It's allowing issuance of citations for overweight and overland commercial vehicles. I believe, Representative Furness, you took a closer look at this legislation the last time.
No, Mr. Chairman, I haven't. This is the one having to do with weights and measures.
Right.
No.
Did you need some more time to
read through it. I don't have any problems with it.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. Good. I guess the issue before the committee is, do we want to sponsor it as a House Labor and Commerce Committee. Representative Furness?
Mr. Chairman, maybe if I could just share some information.
Certainly.
Effectively, one of the new members, if I could choose the members. When we repeal the ATC, the Alaska Transportation Commission, we virtually gutted any ability of either Commerce or Department of Public Safety to conduct certain activities, particularly when it had to do with the highways and the weigh stations and truck overloads or whatever. The voters, as I recall, did vote to repeal that section of statute, and the legislature so complied. I support the attempt to gradually give at least the two departments, Public Safety and Commerce, an ability to get some hold on the industry again, and this is a reasonable vehicle to do it. So with that in mind, I would indeed support our introducing it. Now, I would assume the bill in front of us has a date of 2/27/87. Oh, it's a Senate bill, I see.
Right.
So you're going to do a House tunnel project. Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. What's the point of the court? I'm so moved, Mr. Chairman, that's unanimous consent of the recommendation.
Okay, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, we shall introduce it as a piece of committee legislation. Last matter before us today is if everybody's had a chance to look at the list of nominees and to sign the letter from the committee.
Do we have resumes for people on file?
We have resumes for probably half of the people on file, and those were in your file that we have to deal with. There are some people we have no backup information.
Yeah. Can I see the backup information on the nominee for the Alaska Public Utilities Commission?
Sure. One last thing before everybody takes off is next is Thursday. We're going to try to take a committee picture. We're just going to have staff doing it, so if you want to dress up in a particular way, go for it. We'll shoot up a roll of film, and we'll send around a proof sheet if we get one in, and see if we get a good photo of the group.
Am I allowed to get a patch and the whole work?
I made it.
Only if you wear a Hathaway shirt.
Okay. 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 Commerce Committee is adjourned.
This Thursday,
3:07.